This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, 8:46 a.m, 28th of June, Wednesday, 2017. I'm Koo Soo Chung, joined by Brian Fernandez and Tan Chung Han. And gentlemen, this item from the global news pages where Google, our de facto, technology provider.
Our soon-to-be lords?
Yeah, exactly.
They're just the king of the world, right? But yes, go on.
They've been whacked 2.7 billion euros in fines by the European Commission for violating antitrust laws in the European area, because according to the regulators of them, they have been artificially pushing their Google shopping comparison site ahead of other rival providers to the front page. And the first three pages of search have been Google price comparison results. Whenever anyone types in anything to do with prices and shopping and comparisons. And the thing is, obviously, this is not the first time that the European regulators have stepped in to curtail the influence of American tech giants, be it Microsoft, be it Apple. And this is the latest example, I think, of this whiplash.
Yeah, and I think given that this $2.7 billion fine has been handed out to Google, I think the question here is, what will this do for Google's operation or for its presence, moving forward? Because, if they're having to play ball with the EU regulators, will they then have to tweak their algorithms, and change their search results in order to, at least portray some kind of level playing field? Although some might argue that it might be artificial somewhat.
See, again, this comes to brings the point about the power of the monopolist to manipulate and control prices. So essentially, they are diverting searchers and therefore revenues to their own products. What we should be also concerned about is if they've been slapped on the wrist in Europe, what are they doing in Asia?
Good question. Not much, actually, because a lot of the action in terms of this regulatory whiplash has been happening in Europe. I mean, look, for example, Apple's been ordered to pay 13 billion euros in fines because of this tax inversion. They broke Irish state aid laws. You go back a bit further, Internet Explorer and Microsoft.
Intel, 1.1. The current highest is 1.1 billion fine.
1 billion. Yeah. But according to European antitrust laws, they are allowed to fine the regulators up to 10% of your global revenues, which in Google's case is something as much as 8 billion euros.
Yes.
The fact that they got 2.5%, 2.5% of revenue fine, just I guess it's a little bit of a mitigant, but it is still a huge fine.
But it's also an impact moving forward. Now, that's the current fine. Google will then be under watch for the next 5 years. Mm-hmm. And potentially be fined up to 5% of turnover. So it's not all over yet for Google.
They've got to really watch their game now.
Yeah. I mean, it's only $2.7 billion.
I beg your pardon?
They have $90 billion in the bank.
They've got $90 billion in cash. So what's $2.7? That's not even 10%, right? So when they have the kind of might and that kind of power, the question is, what can the regulators even do? So the question is this a slap on the wrist? Now, going back to the Asian context as well, broadly speaking, we are seen to have a more lax regulatory framework compared to the Europeans when it comes to the on the competitiveness front, right? They're trying to make sure there's a level playing field here. But again, when you're going up against the likes of Google or even Apple for that matter, right?
There is
really
no
how much can you do?
There is no regional overseer in Asia, because in Europe, you've got the European Union, of course, the European Commission is, right? In Southeast Asia, we don't have such an overseer, at least we do, but it's in its infancy. Yeah, so
yeah, and also it's all individual markets have anti-competitive laws, as we do in Malaysia.
Really?
But
sorry, really?
The thing is, enforcement-wise,
Malaysia,
how are we going to go against
monopolies?
The Googles of this world?
Yeah. Anyway, let's localize our discussion, giants, guys, and elegantly move along from what was obviously a sensitive topic to something Malaysian. And it's kind of like Malaysian because this debacle happened in Australia. But the Malaysian connection is a company called Malfa, which has a 23% stake in a company called Aveo, which is a retirement village operator. And they've been the subject of a TV documentary by the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, as well as Fairfax Media, in which they uncovered the scoop that apparently Aveo was illegally and immorally churning residents of the retirement villages to the detriment of the retirees in Australia. Of course, anytime you've got retirees involved and pension commissioners. There's a big public backlash, and that's exactly what happened with Aveo because their shares took a beating, down by 10-11% overnight.
Yeah,
and that's prompting Lee Seng Huang, the executive director of Malfa, to come out and defend their position, the Aveo way, as it were.
Right, 11% drop for Aveo shares in Australia on Monday, although on Tuesday it has recovered a little bit. Somewhat, I'm trying to put up the live numbers here, but my computer is not cooperating with me. Maybe still on the Hari Raya mode, perhaps. I know, but so you have those allegations from that Four Corners program about, you know, how essentially Aveo is or is alleged to have cheated or manipulated a lot of the residents. But Aveo has since issued a couple of responses to the Australian Stock Exchange, and perhaps offering their side of the story. And it's interesting to note that the first point in their response is this, and I quote: "In an independent industry survey, residents indicated that if they had their time over to make the same choice to move into a retirement village, 98% of residents said they would make the same move again." You know, they also responded to that churn target of apparently one of the allegations was that Aveo would make more money when they send people, get them bought in and then move them on out so that they can churn people along. Apparently, there's no such thing as a churn target according to Four Corners. If you want to get more of of the response from Aveo Group, you can check it out on the Australian Stock Exchange. So, I mean, just glancing through it, it appears that from Aveo's stance, they are saying that the Four Corners program highlighted just a few experiences and magnified it. I mean, sensational. It was certainly sensational. It garnered a lot of traction, not just in Australian media, but in social media. Obviously, we're talking about it here because I believe several local media outlets also picked it up, Malay Mail, for example. So it is something that is that has obviously struck a chord with people out there, obviously trying to take advantage or any semblance of taking advantage of the elderly or the weak. That's something that's frowned upon, right?
I think one of the key things here with the Australian experience and in general the Australian retirement home industry has been looked at as a benchmark in terms of how well they run, and lots of property developers in Malaysia see that whole retirement village concept as the next growth area within Malaysia itself. And Malfa, I believe, is also looking at having retirement villages in Malaysia. So that's going to impact them somewhat moving forward.
Yeah, it's the whole community application sense of the word, because property developers in the past, all they did was have to move inventory. Now, if you put a use to those communities and to those properties, then, of course, there's a more compelling proposition to applying that. Okay, let's move along to another item that is also very localized. And I didn't realize, when Raya season comes around and you go and buy your baju, right? You go to the de facto retailer, which is Jekyll. I didn't know they've been doing so well that they can build two towers in KL, comprising service apartments, hotels and offices with a GDV of 1.3 billion ringgit. I had no idea. It's massive business.
Yeah, they've been in the property business since 2015 with their maiden
project. Which is just 2 years long.
Absolutely, in Shiraz. But it just goes to show how profitable the textile and clothing business is, because the cash flow has allowed them to expand and build this new development just beside their existing downtown mall. So it'll comprise 300,000 square feet of mall space, which will house between 150 and 200 shops. It'll have food courts. It will also have a hotel component, shops, and also service apartments of between 550 square foot and 1,200 square foot.
Yeah, but property development appears to be that low-hanging fruit. Very often when these companies, they do well in a single vertical, they think, well, what's next? And very often they reach for property development. So it appears that Jekyll is the next in line here. But again, given the many, many property developers that we speak to on the Breakfast Grill and other elements on our show here on the Morning Run, it makes you wonder, it is already so oversupplied, so many players in there. I wonder what kind of opportunities Jekyll actually sees in that space. Obviously enough for them to build that two tower project in Cheras then, huh?
Yeah, okay. Let's also move along from retail to tourist arrivals and basically low-cost travel. And The Edge spoke to Benjamin Ismail, the CEO of AirAsiaX, a couple of days ago. They've written a story in The Edge Daily citing that even though Q1 numbers came in weaker than expected, I think quarterly profits came in at 10.5 million ringgit odd from 180 million a year ago, comparatively speaking, citing a weak ringgit, higher fuel costs, intense competition. But of course, Benjamin Ismail saying that it's okay, you know, the rest of the year is looking good. And they're pointing to better cost management initiatives from the low-cost airline operator to placate investors.
I think one of the key things with that is also how AirAsia has abandoned, AirAsiaX, sorry, has abandoned the ultra-long-haul model. And they're going for shorter long-haul routes. So, for example, this new Hawaii route is actually off Japan rather than a direct route out of Malaysia. So one of the reasons cited was the fact that they don't have suitable aircraft to make the economics work.
Yeah, I actually did some research on the Japan Honolulu route actually yesterday, and
hey, you're planning for your new holiday? Your next
holiday?
Well,
you know, it's just R&D, you know what I mean? But yeah. I think it takes 7 or 8 hours from Japan to Honolulu, so it's a very long flight. So. Yep. Completely over an expensive ocean, so you don't want anything untoward to happen, you know, be that as it may. But you can get to Honolulu within 15 hours.
Right, and I remember a discussion I had with Moshin Aziz, who's a Maybank Investment aviation analyst, and he didn't seem too upbeat on the route route to Hawaii, because, you know, he basically put it really simply, you know, I mean, how many people from Malaysia are expected to fly to Hawaii by his estimation? Well, again, he seemed a bit more bearish on that front. Now, perhaps the other routes for AirAsiaX that may seem to be more profitable for them. Again, keeping in mind, you know, where oil prices are, right? You know, oil prices have been stubbornly below $50 a barrel. You know, depending on how AirAsia as a group has been hedging their fuel prices, you know, perhaps that can be a boost for their bottom line. Keeping in mind, their net profit for the first quarter fell by 94% year.
But at least it's still making money, I guess.
They
are focused for AirAsiaX has really been China and South Korea, and as they expand moving forward, those are the key areas they're looking at, and they're looking at two new routes this year.
Okay, gentlemen, 8:58 in the morning, a couple more minutes to the opening market hours. We're going to be coming back with more news and analysis, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.